I guess since you have a long story, we won't do anything in this beginning.
That's probably best for
time's
sake.
Who should go first?
Who went first last time?
You.
Oh, then you go first.
Okay. So today, my story is about the Blue Men of the Minch, also known as Storm Kelpies, but they're mostly known as the Blue Men of the Minch. I got my information from Wikipedia. I can't talk today. From Wikipedia. Wikipedia.org.
You can do it.
This is all a typo. Or it's all correct.
The White Hoose? No, that makes sense.
.co.uk?
Yeah.
It might be We White House. I don't know if I type on or not.
It could also be something about like how...
Transceltic.com, Scotsman.com.
Yeah, like Scottish dialect of house.
HarrisDistillery.com and TheMinch.com. So, here's our history about them. So, the Blue Men of the Minch are mythological creatures that inhabit the stretch of water between the northern outer Hebrides and mainland Scotland.
They're really just all about Scotland these last two episodes.
I know. They are said to be looking for sailors to drown and stricken boats to sink. I mean, we're not all about... I mean, I like Scotland. That's one place that Drew said he would live. But, no, we just found other stories from...
Just, yeah, when you're searching one, you found more. Yeah. You're like, well, might as well cover them while I'm thinking about them.
And it's, like, more stuff we haven't heard of. Mm-hmm. But it's stuff that we don't have to, like, translate, really, to...
Yeah, I can read all the sources and don't think... Like, know that I'm missing out on things.
Yeah. They are specifically localized to the Minch, with no Blue Men legends being told in any other parts of the world. Author John Gregerson Campbell says... I forgot there were three parts. That's why it sounded so weird to his name. Says they were unknown in...
Argyll.
Okay. That I was going to say, I do not know how to say that. On the nearby coast of the mainland, but Church of... Scotland minister John Brand, who visited Quarf in Shetland in mid-1700, recounts a tale of what may have been a blue man in the waters around the island. So, if you know where Quarf is, that can mean something to you. I have no clue where that is. This person that this minister saw was in the form of a bearded old man, and it rose out of the water, and it terrified all the passengers and crew that were on the boat that it was following.
Ew.
So, like,
I don't like... It's just like a
humanoid Ariel's
thing.
Dad. What's his name?
Yeah, like, when Trident comes out of the water to go up to the side of the ship.
Okay. So, I took these notes, like, 2 weeks ago. I don't know why I'm, like, not remembering anything. Like, I remember the, like, what I said about
the
most
story,
of it.
Yeah,
but not
words
the,
out.
None of the people that I'm talking about. Okay, so Donald Alexander Mackenzie wrote a book called Wonder Tales from Scottish Myth and Legend, and it was published in 1917, which described the legend of the creatures.
Oldie but a goodie.
Quote, the strait which lies of the blue men, they are human size, and they have great strength. By day and by night, they swim round in between the Shant Isles, and the sea there is never at rest. They are never at rest. The blue men wear blue caps and gray faces, which appear above the waves that they... raise their long, restless arms. In summer weather, they swim lightly below the surface, but when the wind is high, they revel in the storm and swing their heads erect, splashing the waters with mad delight. Sometimes they are seen floating from the waist out to... out.
Yeah, from their waist out to sea.
Oh.
They're floating from the waist out to sea. They're going out to sea.
Okay. I was like, what is that? Waist out to sea. Okay, anyway. So, and sometimes turning round like porpoises when they dive. So, like Donald said, they are said to look very much like humans and are about the same size as humans. But they are blue-colored. Like, their skin is blue-colored. And some sources also said that their skin shines in the light. And that some reported them having fish tails instead of legs, but that's not, like, the widely covered myth, basically.
They're not really usually mermaids. They're usually humans.
Yeah, that are blue, like avatars. but they're not giant size like avatars.
Yeah.
They have long gray faces, and some also have really long arms, which are also gray. So I don't know, like, I don't understand this blue, like, are their torso and body the only, or torso and, like,
my
legs
the only blueprint? Really bad today.
But anything, anyway, basically blue everything gray. Said that they had gray faces.
Blue gray.
So, anyway, one account claims that they also have wings, but I didn't see that everywhere, so. They have the power to create storms, but when the weather is fine, they float sleeping on or just below the surface of the water. They also sleep slash live in underwater caves in a clan system.
Okay.
The caves that they live in are by a stretch of water known as the Current of Destruction, and many ships have wrecked there. It is said that if you spot them in the waves, it is a sure sign that a storm is approaching. They swim with their torsos raised out of the sea, twisting and diving like porpoises. When they're bored, they play shinty, which I don't know what that is.
I assume it's a game?
Well, it's a game, but I just don't know what it is. When the skies are clear and bright at night, that's when they play this game. They are also able to speak, and they are especially vocal when soaking ships with water spray and roaring with laughter as ships capsize. If the Blue Men gather to attack a ship, it is said that they will shout to the captain of the ship, challenging and threatening in verse. They engage in a rhyming duel, reciting a poem to the master of the ship, demanding that the verse be completed. If the skipper can do this successfully and achieves the last word, then the ship may be spared. If the captain fails, then the Blue Men will attempt to overturn the ship and capsize it. Supposedly, they have guards on the lookout for vulnerable ships, and they will target those who mistreat the Selkies and other sea folk. So they're ocean activists who like to have rap battles.
And play a Scottish version of field hockey.
Shinty.
That's what it is. Well, similar to field hockey. It's not...
Apparently, they only played it at night, though.
Mm.
When they're
like the
twilight clear and bright.
Like the Twilight Vampires
that
only play baseball during
thunderstorms.
Yeah,
correct.
Mythological creatures love playing sports, but only at extremely
nighttime.
Specific times.
The sky has to be just exactly what they're looking for. If they do not decide to engage in a rap battle with you, they sometimes board a passing vessel and demand tribute from its crew, threatening that if they are not forthcoming, they will create a storm. So not like necessarily capsize the ship, but just make your journey not fun to be on. In Superstitions of the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, published in 1900, John Gregerson Campbell described a blue-colored man with a long gray face that followed boats slowly on the water, but just never quite in reach of them. Like, he's just, I don't know if he's, like, deciding if he wants to get them or what. One tale is of a great ship with white sails that cut swiftly through the Minch like an arrow in flight, despite the high winds and turbulent waves. As the Blue Men rose from their caves on the seafloor, some grabbed hold of the keel of the vessel and were surprised to find it steady and solid. The chief, this story says that his name was Shoney, of the Blue Men, so this Blue Men chief had a name,
chief of the Blue
Men.
Okay.
Made his way to the front of the ship, and from the waves he shouted, quote, "Man of the black cap, what do you say as your proud ship cleaves the brine?" The skipper answered, quote, "My speedy ship takes the shortest way, and I'll follow you line by line." The chief of the Blue Men had never been met with a response that was an answer and a challenge, so he responded angrily, quote, "My men are eager, my men are ready to drag you beneath the waves." The skipper replied, quote, "My ship is fast, my ship is steady. If you sank it, it would wreck your caves." So the chief of the Blue Men had been bested, and he had no choice but to retreat back below the waves, and the ship went freely on with safe passage through the Minch. There's also a tale of the time a Blue Man was captured. A ship's crew found him sleeping on the waters on a calm summer's day and pulled him aboard. The crew bound him from ankle to shoulder with the strongest rope they could find until it seemed like it was impossible for him to move. And the ship hadn't moved far from where they had captured him when two blue men were spotted speeding through the water towards it. When they reached the ship, one of them was heard saying, quote, "Duncan will be one." The other replied, "Duncan will be two. Will you need another air you reach the shore?" The skipper of the boat was about to shout a couplet in reply, but before he could, the blue man on the ship opened his eyes and snapped free from the rope and said, quote, "Duncan's voice I hear, Donald too is near, but no need of helpers had strong Ian Moore? Mahor? Moore? Anyway.
No.
Anyway, he then jumped off the ship and swam free. Let me see here. So all of the sources that I was looking at said that the people from the Outer Hebrides are all proud of their folklore and that many locals viewed the blue men as helpful if treated with care and respect. Legend tells of ale being poured into the water as a gift to persuade the blue men to leave seaweed on the beach as fertilizer. There's also a tradition of lighting a candle by the sea on the night of the Celtic festival of Samhain.
I know that's not how you say that, but
which
I don't
is
remember
their
how
version
you say
of Halloween. So, now we're on to like their origin story, basically. And it's not clear where the blue men come from. The origins of the myth go as far back as the Vikings.
That's Samhain. Samhain. I was like, I know it. It's like at the tip of my tongue, Samhain.
Yeah, I've heard it like that. I just didn't know that's how it was spelled. So it's not clear where the blue men came from. The origins of the myth go as far back as the Vikings and have similarity to the tales of Kelpie, which are water spirits in Scottish folklore. But these are called storm Kelpies, but that's not the same thing as Kelpies. That's another story we could cover because Kelpies are like sirens, basically, mm-hmm. I think.
They're a whole different
thing. They're ladies. They're not blue men. So some believe that they could have been a part of a tribe of fallen... Oh, here. This isn't a quote. I don't know what it's from, though. Fallen angels that split into three. The first become the ground-dwelling fairies. The second evolved and became the blue men. And the rest became merry dancers of the northern lights in the sky. Which I've never heard that, but that's fun. So Donald... This author that I've talked about before, I can't remember his first name. His first name might be Donald.
Our first name, which one ever it is.
I don't know. It could be a first or a last. Anyway.
That's true.
So, he believed that the legend of the blue men was based partly on research into the annals of Ireland. Is that how you say that?
Sure.
And goes back to the times of Harland Fairhair. Fairer, the first Norse king and his battles against the Vikings. The Scottish Gaelic term fear. I should have like Googled how to say these things. I would have remembered it was
not,
2 weeks
not,
ago.
It's not how you think the letters are. That's all went out.
Fear Gorma. We're gonna say that. It means blue men. Okay.
We know we're mispronouncing.
Is a descriptor for a black man, according to Dwelly. Which I had to look that up because this is on Wikipedia. And I'm like, who's Dwelly? Do we just all know who that is? So, he is Edward Dwelly. He was born in 1864, died 1939. He was an English lexicographer? Lexicographer? Can I just not read today? And genealogist. He created the authoritative dictionary of Scottish Gaelic. But I was like, I don't understand what this man is doing creating this.
So
he's
going through and taking every single word down that he's learning all these episodes, but he's making a lexicography, right? I think that's a word. That's a thing. Lexigram.
But I'm also like, I don't know if I trust this man because the Gaelic language can be traced back as early as 3200 BC.
Yeah, but it hadn't been written down before. He's the one who's taking them all down. I think...
So we're supposed to take this man's
word
for it.
If I remember right, he's like... Because it's such a dying language, Scottish Gaelic is a dying language. that he's, like, one of the utmost authorities at this point because they've lost so much of it that, like, mm-hmm. at least is something to go off of. It's really common in a lot of dying languages that one person a long time ago, even if they weren't the best resource then, is the only thing that's remaining of some of this stuff.
But I thought that was worth noting because how much can we trust him?
Oh, yeah, that's, like, half of my story is just,
well,
like,
that's why
caveats.
I'm saying, like, he's saying that this could be meaning this. That's why I'm, like, noting who this guy yeah. is and when he was alive compared to when the language started. I don't want everybody to think, like, he knows it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's, like, fluent in it and
he's,
knows everything.
He's not even Scottish, is he?
No, he's English.
I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, English.
So, I was like, I swear I said it. So, around the 9th century, the Vikings took Moors, a term used by Christian Europeans for Muslim populations of the Maghreb?
It's a region.
Andalus, Sicily, and Malta. Sorry, I don't know these things. During the Middle Ages. So, that's the Moors is...
So it would be, like, around Spain.
The Muslim population in that area is what they, their term
would
for
be,
it.
Would be those other two, I think.
And if it's an offensive term, I'm sorry, I don't know. But it was just openly in Wikipedia, and there were no, like, you don't click on it and it says something bad. It just took you to the pages that said what it was.
I think it's an old ethnic group.
I know, but I don't know.
But just
know
in case.
I'm like, I'm not trying to say anything bad. That they had captured and were using as slaves and were taking to Ireland. The Vikings spent winter months near the St. Isles, and Donald attributed the story of the blue men to marooned foreign slaves. This is just, you know, speculation
and that,
from
and that's
where
him
this
connecting
origin is coming from.
The origin
from.
Of the mm-hmm. word coming from black men.
Yes.
So, yeah, people with darker
so,
skin colors.
So, historian Malcolm Archibald agrees. Why did I say it like that?
You said historian like it was his first name.
Historian Malcolm Archibald agrees the legend originates from the days Norsemen had North African slaves, but speculates that the myth originated with the Tuareg people of
sure.
Sahara Africa, who were known as the Blue Men of the Desert.
Huh?
I didn't
really
look into that, but I don't know.
Like, far-fetched. Like, we're really, really pushing it at this
so
point.
So the origin of the Blue Men of the Minch also may be from the tattooing people, specifically the Picts, whose Latin name Pict means painted people.
Mm-hmm.
They were seen crossing the water in boats resembling kayaks to the Finnmen, or kayaks of the Finnmen, which I don't know what that is either. They may have given the islanders and mariners the impression of the upper part of their body rising
out
of the water.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Other people believe that the Blue Men of Minch are all just a personification of the treacherous waters they inhabit. Some also suspect that the stories came from the mammals often seen around the Shant Isles. I can't remember how I said it. Like common dolphins, gray seals, Rizzo's dolphins, and porpoises, which are all known to be great swimmers in rough seas.
Well, some of them, like, when you see them a certain way, very weirdly human-like.
Mm-hmm.
Like without you see all of their muscles.
I can't
and
see
bones
any of them having
things.
Long arms, though.
No, that's a different thing. Well, and, like, on top of that, like, they've presented a human version. I don't buy any of the human versions for it, except for the kayaking.
I mean,
one.
I just
I
think
like
it's worth mentioning
stuff.
Because it's
no,
in
yeah.
not just the Wikipedia, but every other source
yeah,
that I looked at.
Yeah, they're trying to
so.
Understand where mythologies come from. That's
yeah.
The thing they're not mentioning, though, is mirages. And having seen sea mirages, they're convincing.
Because that could be another one, too.
That's
so
my...
That
my
is...
bone to throw
that's
into that
all
line.
I have on the Blue Men of the Minch, also
like
known as storm kelpies. If only I could talk, that'd be really nice. But yeah, I thought it'd be a little bit longer, especially with, like, I thought maybe more people would do more research.
They would have more theories
into,
or,
you
like,
know, which exact way the Vikings went, you know, if it would make sense that the Blue Men would be in that area for that.
I don't. I think.
Kind of thing.
I think
you know what
that
I mean?
Whole line
I don't
of reasoning
know.
Is sort of ridiculous.
I don't know.
And I could be totally wrong. I am no expert in any of this, but that I don't often like those forms of reasoning.
You never know. I wasn't there.
But they're both less fun and feel somehow yucky, and I couldn't explain that better, but because it's my feelings, but.
Well, anyway. I'm like, I'm confused. Like, were all of them getting out of the boat and swimming away?
That's what I don't understand. Why would they be in the water like that? But that's, I do like the kayaks.
So I don't know.
Because that's a wild thing, especially in rough seas. You're not going to see all of them.
Yeah.
So, my story.
Yes. Everybody buckle up.
That's the point of this. I love buckling. You know, here's the thing. Buckle up. It's going to be an odd ride.
A long ride.
Get comfortable. So I'm going to cover the fairy flag. My sources are...
The what? Flag?
Fairy flag.
Okay.
My sources are Wikipedia, historic-uk.com, and then dunvigancastle.com. I think it's Dunvigan.
I mean, you should have heard how many things I mispronounce.
I'm trying my best. And there's a few things. I don't understand the phonetic alphabet, so it'll just show me the phonetic alphabet, and I'll be like, I don't know still. Thanks. So we're going to start with Clan MacLeod. I believe that is how you say it. It's spelled MacLeod. I think it's MacLeod. Everything I looked up makes me think it's MacLeod. It's easier to say.
Yeah.
So Clan MacLeod are the descendants of Loud. Or Leod. The clan has two branches, the MacLeods of Dunvigan, Harris, and Glenelg.
Yep.
And the MacLeods of Lewis. The MacLeods of Lewis, Essence, and Race. We're assuming I'm not typoing as well, so we're doing our best. Usually when we're referring to them,
a lot of the problems with my typos
MacLeod of Dunvigan and then MacLeods of Lewis are like the two separate groups.
Yeah.
They only come up like a little bit. It's not super, super important for the story. So Loud was the brother of Olaf the Black, one of the first Norse kings of Man. And I assume Man means like the Isles of Man.
What was my Norse king?
Not Man as a whole. I don't think it was Olaf. Anyway. They died in 1265. That's not the same as 19. So, yeah. Olaf the Black died in 1265 when the Hebrides were finally ceded to Scotland. So that's why I think he's king of the Isles of Man and then some surrounding areas, which would have included the Hebrides. And this is assuming the Isles of Man are near the Hebrides. I don't exactly know where they are. Anyway... That's when we get Loud, and around 1265, I think. So Loud inherits the islands of Lewis and Harris, as well as Slate, Trotternish, Waternish, and Snizort of Skye. It's a very funnily spelt word. Snizort of Skye.
Snizor.
So he has a ton of little islands that he inherits. And then after his marriage to the daughter of Norse... Oh my goodness gracious. The Norse Seneschal of Skye. I assume that's some sort of title. I looked it up earlier. I don't remember anymore. So anyway, Leod marries the daughter of a Norse sort of nobility position. Anyway, the nobility position is over Skye MacRald Amriel. And he was granted the lands of Glenelg Durinish, Minganish, Bracadale, Lindale, and Dunvigan Castle. So he has a whole bunch of areas and islands is the point of this. And so he makes Dunvigan the home of the clan chief, and that's what it's been ever since. So Lud dies in 1295, and the land is divided between his two sons, and this is how the two branches of the clan are formed.
He died in 1290.
I think you're saying,
you might be looking at that five down there, and it's all the only five I could see. Like, what are you looking at?
I can't read today.
It's okay. I can't either. It's late in the day,
It's late in the day.
We're struggling.
It's a lot of new words. I've never had to say it loud before. Anyway, so he dies in 1290. He splits all of his
assets.
Places. Yeah, his assets between his two sons. This is how the two branches of the clan are formed. So, Lewis and Dunvegan. So, the clan motto is Hold Fast, which originates from Malcolm MacLeod, the third chief, who, while traveling back from a secret meeting in Glenelg, he was confronted with a wild bull. As he wrestled the wild bull, his fellow clansmen shouted, Hold Fast, MacLeod. He overcame the bull and killed it. Hold Fast has been their motto ever since. That was just a fun fact.
How did he kill it?
That wasn't specific. Was it with a dirk. No, with a dirk. Which is, it's a Scottish long dagger.
Just a knife.
Traditionally carry.
It's a knife, okay.
That was said in the story. I didn't expect you to ask. So I didn't include it when I wrote it down.
Well, you're saying it's like he choked him out or something.
He killed it. It didn't matter how. Beat him against a rock. I don't know what it was. No, it was with a jerk. So Dunvegan Castle is located on the Isle of Skye off the west coast of Scotland. The inhabitants of the location predate a fortification on the spot. People lived there for a long time is the point of what I'm saying there. And the first dates for that I could easily find, I'm sure there may have been fortifications there earlier, but the earliest dates for fortification on the spot was a curtain wall that was built sometime in the 1200s, which makes sense. That would sort of mean that this castle is like brand spanking new when it's inherited by the MacLeods, which is fun. So a four-story tower house was added in the late 1300s to the curtain wall. And this tower was similar to other contemporary structures like that at Kissimmee Castle. Not that that means anything to you, but it might mean something to someone else. Now they're like, oh yeah, now I know exactly what it looks like. It just sort of means it's a four-story tall house-like building. It's not like thin, it's thick.
Yeah.
And just four stories was a lot back then. So around 1500, the eighth chief... Yeah, it's true. Four-story house would be a lot. So around 1500, the eighth chief, Alistair Crotach, we come back to him a few times along here, I realize now, added a building called the Fairy Tower. In, oh me, oh my, what do you think this number was supposed to be? Because I have 18,623 written. I think it's supposed to be 1623. I don't think we're to 18 yet based on later dates. So in 1623... A state apartment was added between the two towers, so between the four-story tower and the fairy tower. And then additional structures were added to, fill in the space between the two towers, because the towers weren't built next to each other, built on opposite sides. And then they built a little building in the middle, and then they built everything else, so it's one, more castle-like structure.
Yeah.
With the addition of the new buildings, the old tower fell out of use, so the original, the four-story tower, falls out of use until the 1700s, when the 23rd chief begins the process of homogenizing the appearance of the castle, so it's big old facelift on the castle to make it look like one complete structure and not a whole bunch of buildings built at extremely different times.
Yeah.
The 24th and 25th chiefs continue this process, adding mock battlements so it looks more fun, and a new approach and drawbridge from the east side of the castle, so it sounds like they entirely changed where the entrance to everything is. I don't know where the original entrance was. The present appearance dates back to around 1840. It looks very castle-y now.
Yeah.
Very classic castle. Not like classic Disney castle, like classic medieval castle kind of thing. So now on to the fairy flag. Dear Lord, I'm going to butcher this entirely.
That's what we do here.
So... when I read it, it looks like this. Bratach Sith. And I know that's not how you say it. But my tongue couldn't wrap around it, so I'd rather just tell you what the letters look like. Anyway, the fairy flag of Dunvegan. So there are a number of descriptions of the flag, which vary over time. So around 1799, the flag is described as having a cross of golden thread on it, as well as several elf spots stitched on it. No clue what an elf spot is.
What the heck is that?
But this is terminology used more than once in its description, so it must be a thing.
We're supposed to know.
And then in 1814, the flag is described as a silk pennant embroidered with red roan berries. So I'm assuming that's describing these elf spots.
I don't know.
And then in 1871, the flag was described as made of yellow raw silk with figures and spots worked on it in red. So I, again, assume these elf spots are at least consistently. Yeah. There's spots on it
that are
round and red.
Yep.
In 1927, the flag described as being square and brown. 18 inches, 45 centimeters square. So that's how big it would be. Square-wise,
mm-hmm.
across and up and down. The observer also mentioned that he believed the original flag had been much larger and remarked that it was extremely fragile, and it also had gone through, like, a lot of, like, testing and pieces have been taken off of it and all that. So between it being old and fragile and then also having had pieces removed in the past, he's right, it would have been bigger. elf spots are also noted during this description as being discernible still, like they were there, but there's no longer evidence of the cross, so that might have been a piece that had been snipped off at some point. If it had ever existed, we don't know one way or the other, because we don't really have any early descriptions of it other than it existed. It's all like really lorry. The thing is, it does exist. This is a real piece of fabric that the clan still has.
Over time, yeah.
Well, yeah, because it's aging, so it could have been yellow, and it probably wasn't originally yellow. That's another aging color, mm-hmm. and then now it's brown from the aging, and... Because that's what happens to things over time. So there are a few tales about how the fairy flag came into possession of the Clan MacLeod. Good night. I'm going to try again.
Of the clan. Just move on.
There are a few tales about how the fairy flag came into possession of the Clan MacLeod. It's almost a tongue twister. So one is the fairy tower. So one night during a feast at the castle, a nurse placed the chief's son in his cradle in the fairy tower, which we know is a place that was built.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there. And then she left him there to join the party. The baby became restless and kicked off his blanket while crying. A fairy appeared and comforted the baby, wrapping him in a silken shawl. The nurse returned to collect the child, bringing him to the party in his new fairy garb, just like scooping him up. It's dark. There's no lights.
Yeah.
I'm like, there's fire, but fire's not very good at night. And then upon entering the party, with the baby and shawl, the room filled with the sounds of unseen singers singing the fairy lullaby, which is apparently like a known tune because of the way the story was described. So that's story number one. A fairy gifts it to a baby. Lovely.
That's nice.
The next story is that of the Crusader. So a MacLeod on a crusade to the Holy Land found food and shelter with a hermit in the mountain pass. In a mountain pass, not the. It's more than a mountain pass. And before the man set out again, the hermit warned him of an evil spirit that guarded the mountain pass, and the man needed a piece of the true cross in order to successfully make it through the pass.
What, from Jesus?
Yeah, like the true cross, because remember, this is the Crusades when they're going to find all these relics. Like, that was the big thing.
I was like, where is he just supposed to get that from?
He's supposed to have stolen it from one of the many churches in the area. That's why
he's
really there.
That's really godly.
Theft. So it turns out, he didn't need a piece of the true cross. He just needed to kill the spirit, who was also the daughter of thunder. And he successfully did this.
How?
Before she... Not described to me in this particular short story.
Come on.
So before she died... She revealed to him the future of his clan and told him to take her girdle and make a banner from it and mount it on her spear shaft. So I assume it was like a weapons-based battle.
Yeah.
Because she has a spear. And that's how they get it.
She's just accepting that fate. I'm like, all
she's dying.
Take this back to your clan. Yeah, but the last thing I'm doing is helping him.
No, it's...
I'm like, you'll be cursed. Your clan is cursed.
Right.
You'll never have
it's
children
odd that,
again.
That he would help them in this situation. There's...
She.
Oh, yeah, you're right, she. Anyway, next is the fairy bridge. So...
What the heck?
So the story starts with the marriage of a fairy to a MacLeod chief. They live together as husband and wife for a year and a day. The year and a day will come back in other stories, by the way. It's just a big thing.
Normal people?
No, they're... Remember, there's like the three people, there's the fairies, the...
Yeah, but are they smaller like we all think they are?
No, like this is more like... Like Elven Fae, like in Lord of the Rings.
I was gonna say, is he just married like Tinkerbell?
No, more like Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
So anyway, they live together.
Well, because I know they look like people.
As husband and wife for a year and a day, and which point the fairy returns to her own world. They part ways at the fairy bridge near Dunvegan, which I'm sure is a place that everybody knows where it is still. Before she crosses the bridge, she gives her husband a parting gift, a banner, that if waved while, like, during hard-pressed times of battle, it would bring the waver victory, no matter the odds of the battle. This is also a common theme. This ability, she warned, could only work 3 times. Another common theme.
Uh-huh. Demonic, it seems, almost.
So, sometime after the banner was gifted to Clan MacLeod, they partook in 2 battles, both of which they flew the fairy banner over and won, according to this story set. So in 1939, and this is still all under the fairy bridge,
yeah,
by the way, these are all connected. So in 1939, there was a fire in the south wing that threatened to destroy the whole castle, and the fairy banner was removed from the building, carried to safety. And then after it's, like, taken out of the building and, like, gotten out,
yeah,
right? So therefore, like, sort of, they waved it again. The winds that had been feeding the flames dropped, and the fire seemed to lessen in intensity, so, like, it worked again, is the idea that this is the third use. During World War II, pilots from Clan MacLeod carried a picture of the flag to bring them luck.
Yeah.
So, here's the thing. They're under the Fairy Bridge story, but there was a fire in 1939, and pilots from the clan did... like, where it is things. And then the third thing that I'm about to read also was a real thing that happened. So it's also said that Dame Flora, the Clan MacLeod leader, during, I believe, World War II, she was the one who helped, like, reunite the clans. They'd, like, really drifted apart in the world through, like, diaspora and other such things, you know, just depopulation of the country land and going to the cities, things like that. Brought them back together. So she's, like, a big... person in their clan history. She offered to fly it over the cliffs of Dover in an effort to use its magic to repel German invasion. Very nice of her.
She should have.
I don't think the Germans ever invaded up there.
Just in case.
So that's the Fairy Bridge story. We're gonna have a few more things that are similar to that going down the line. There's a lot of theories. So, this is another thing that occurred based on old manuscripts we have. In 1480, the Battle of Bloody Bay occurred. It is said that during the battle, William Dubb, who was chief at the time, was killed, and this led his clan to, like, lessen more. Like, they're like, oh no, our leader's died, and they, like, lose the will to fight kind of thing. Like, they're still fighting, but it's like...
Not as hard as they could be. What are we fighting for?
Yeah, that kind of idea. So anyway, a priest orders the flag bearer, Mircha Brick, to unfurl the fairy flag to help rally the clan. When the flag is unfurled, it causes the MacLeods of Harris and Dunvegan, who had been previously fighting against the MacLeods of Lewis, to join together. So now all the MacLeods are fighting together. But it's too late, and the MacLeods lose the battle. So... this is one of, like, the battles is traditionally part of that, too, fairy...
Yeah.
The bridge story. But they did not actually win that one, according to legend, but it did give them a whole bunch of people on their side.
Yeah.
So it did help, just not in time. So amongst the dead was included the flag bearer, Mirka Breck, and the 12 guardians of the flag, which is, like, a big... thing that we'll get to later. The 12 guardians and the flag bearer are really, really, like, highly honored positions. So Mirka Breck is said to be buried alongside William Dubb, which is, like, a crazy high honor to be buried alongside, like, the chief when you both died in battle together. Mm-hmm. Like, the highest honor you could have on his remains. It's like, this is a very highly regarded item, no matter what. So 10 years later, in 1490, the Battle of Glendale occurs. During this battle, both sides of the McLeod clan are losing to the McDonalds, so the McLeods are fighting together again against the McDonalds. Alistair Krotak, who we talked about before, who built the fairy tower, who's chief of the McLeods at the time, orders the fairy flag to be unfurled, after which the clan's renews its effort, and despite having had terrible losses, do actually win the battle. It's not like a great win, but they won. Again, the flag bearer dies, and this time...
Not a good time.
Yeah, this flag bearer was Paul Dubb, so...
Dun, dun, dun.
Two Dubs died. Poor Dubs. So
it's a tough job to be a flag bearer.
No, truly, it is. You're a very easy target.
You've got nothing.
And you have to hold the flag so you can defend yourself. So Thomas Pennant made a tour of the Hebrides in 1772, which talked about the flag in his, like, little tour book.
Uh-huh.
So in his travel guide, it said that the flag had been gifted to the McLeods by Titania, wife of Oberon, king of the fairies. Like, he includes a mythology in his little book about this flag. Though this one is less reliable because Tatiana is an invention of William Shakespeare and appears in Midsummer's Night Dream, and then, like, people like it a lot, so they start to add it to, like, the existing mythologies because they've given a figure that probably exists in their mythologies, like, a good name.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So this is a for real fake mythology.
Yeah, this one's just to sell his... You know.
Fair enough.
Let's go see the Hebrides travel book. So this story is similar to the fairy bridge in that the banner was blessed with the powers that could only be used 3 times. And then after the third use, the banner's powers, the banner would have no more powers, obviously. And then it would have been carried off by an invisible being and never seen again. Like, that's how it was supposed to work in this story.
They retrieve it.
Like, and that's it. Just in case
your
you
three
use it
wishes
again.
Are gone.
Your 3 wishes are gone. You don't get any more. So then he goes on to mention, what's his name? Pennant goes on to mention the 3 times that it was used. So once in the battle between the McLeods and McDonald's, which is a thing that did happen, whether or not the flag was actually there, that's like this battle did happen.
Yeah.
And it increased their power. When they used it during this battle, it increased the size of the McLeod's forces by 10, which is sort of like combining the two battles. Granted, I don't know what the original battle, who they were fighting against, it could have been against the McDonald's, but it's describing them beating the McDonald's and then also having their force greatly increase, which would be when the two sides of the McLeod's come together. So that's sort of interesting.
Yeah.
The next time is to save the life of the lady of the clan during childbirth, and therefore saving the clan's heir, because this is the wife of the previous chief, and the chief had died, but she was pregnant, and there was, like, a whole thing over who got to be in charge next, because, you know, just because you're pregnant doesn't mean you're going to have a baby that is living. So the flag was used once to save her, and then the last time was to save Thomas Pennant himself. But at this point, the flag was so tattered that Titania saw no point in taking it back. So we really...
it just shows
a lot of that Thomas Pennant. He also, though, notes that this is, like, the weirdest thing of, like, mixture of, like, no, that's, like, a semi-real version of history, and then, like, absolutely wild. Because he also goes on to mention that the banner...
Romeo and Juliet.
Maybe related... to the clan's Norse heritage, which is true. It has Norse heritage, like a lot of people around there. Like, your story talked about it, too. And that it's because it's really similar to raven banners that Vikings used. And these are banners that are, like, flown by the chieftain. May have been totemic in nature. Like, you know, religious have magical power in nature.
What are they called?
Which is, like, a raven banners.
Raven.
Yeah.
What are they called now?
Like, for Odin's ravens.
Why would I know that?
I assume you've at least seen Thor, the Marvel movie. I think they're in that. It's common.
I don't remember birds.
It's like, if you have any Norse mythology knowledge, you know that Odin has ravens. In the 1800s, a manuscript is written. I think it's written, not found. Written, describing the ritual surrounding the flag. It says that 12 men of either the highest and purest blood of the race, or who were the most renowned heroes, would be selected to guard the flag. So just, like, the really high ups in, either people who have, like, proven themselves in battle or high ups in the clan, just, you know, inheritance-wise,
yeah,
are the ones who get to be the guardians of the flag. These 12 men would always be, like, positioned behind the chief. So, like, there, it's the chief and then these guys. I don't know if they had, like, any council ability or if they were just, like, the best of the best warrior kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the symbolic guard. And then there's also a hereditary, flag unfurler. So, like, the flag bearer, like, the two individuals that died in battle.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hereditary thing. To both, have that position and to be the one to actually unfurl it. And that needs to be the oldest living male of this hereditary line. And I could be misunderstanding part of that, but I'm trying my best. But there's, like, a lot of symbolism and ritual and significance to all of it. So the manuscript also discusses the flag's origin and describes the previously told Crusader story as well. Like, that's where that story comes from. It also talked about how the third use of the banner would either grant the clan complete victory over their enemies or meant that the clan would suffer total extinction. And because of this, the clan had avoided using the flag for the third time because, like, would have forgotten.
Fair enough.
Which sort of goes in line with, at this point, whoever's writing this down is like, they haven't used it a third time,
mm-hmm.
which means penance. About nonsense about it saving his life. At some point, the flag becomes too tattered to display, so they lock it in an iron chest, and then the hereditary flag bearer becomes the keeper of the key instead, because it just is old. It was old when it was old.
Yeah.
So Sir Reginald MacLeod of MacLeod, who's the 27th chief, recounts a number of these legends as well as some additional ones. So he is, like, the keeper of the legends for a whole bunch of the ones I just told you, and then I'm going to add some additional ones that weren't recorded in another place I was reading. So, except for the Crusader story is from that manuscript. He does have a Crusader story. It's similar. So there's a Crusader story from Clan MacLeod, joins in a crusade to the Holy Land. While in the desert, he comes across a witch. So we've already changed two things.
Oh,
it's
nice.
Desert and witch instead of mountain and hermit. He manages to escape the witch. It's not that the witch helped him. The witch captures him.
He ran away.
After which, he comes to a river and proceeds to cross it. While in the water, a fairy maiden appears in the water, blocking his path. The two struggle, but he overcomes the fairy and crosses the river. And apparently during this struggle, they become friends. I guess it was, like, a, you know, like, it was the concept of, like, oh, good fight.
Yeah.
You know? I assume,
you know,
that's
actually,
what we're...
actually...
I haven't had a nice challenge like that in a while.
Yeah.
We're friends now. Anyway, they become friends. She gives him a box of lovely scented wood, inside of which there are a number of smaller boxes. No, like cedar. Like,
yeah.
The wood smells good. Like a Russian nesting doll, like a
matryoshka. Yeah.
So, like, inside the box, there's a box, and there's a box, and there's a box, and there's a box, and there's a box. And inside the littlest box is where the fairy flag is. And he's told that, like, he can take this home. This is his prize, this little box with the fairy flag in it. But he can't open it until
can't
a year.
Keep the scented wood, I guess.
A year and a day after their wrestling match, right? So he goes home, and his wife
is
like...
It's like an extended warranty kind
of thing. It's like an extended warranty kind of thing. And if he opens it... that year there will be no crops on his lands, no livestock will have any new babies, and no children will be born. But
not for
when he opens
year.
It and uses the flag, like, hordes of men will appear alongside him to help defeat somebody in battle, right? Because that's the most common thing coming back is the ability to defeat
it's
people
like
in battle
the,
by using the
it's
flag.
It's like the ghost army in Lord of the Rings.
Exactly.
It's my favorite scene.
Mine too. Either way, he gets back. His wife is like, no, I want to see what's inside the box. And it hasn't been a year and a day yet. So she opens it. Immediately, a horde of our men appear. So it held up its end of the bargain, but no children were born that year was the trade-off. But we have a new horde of men. Do we need any children that year? Do you get to keep them indefinitely? That's not that's not specified.
It's a good question.
So it did work. According to the story. Ever since that incident, the banner was not used, waiting for a time when an army of men might be needed to save the clan.
That's funny.
So, Reginald, who tells a whole bunch of the stories, and I just recounted the one, he brings the banner to Victoria and Albert Museum in London to have it preserved in 1927. There, a Mr. Wace, I don't know anything more about him, but he's some sort of expert, told Reginald his theory on the banner's origin. Mr. Wace thought that Norseman Harald Hardrada? Sure. An early ancestor of the chiefs of MacLeod. This is like a real thing. He is an ancestor before Loud. Anyway, it says that he got the banner while on expedition to plunder the pilgrim routes in the Middle East, which is, by the way, that's all that being a crusader is plundering the routes of the pilgrims in the Middle East.
Yeah.
So he's also just a Viking doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So he brought the banner back to Britain, and where he was killed in 1066. That's just sort of just cementing that he was definitely, like, in the area of Britain during a time frame that is, like, relevant to the family history, is why that's mentioned. So it speculated, this is separate now, that's his theory. It speculated that around the same time, other people are speculating where this flag comes from, right? So it's speculated that the silk fabric originated either in Syria or Rhodes, and that the embroidery was done somewhere in the Near East. It's, like, not specified where. So this is in, like, 1927 that they're speculating this. They also think that it is, like, entirely possible that, because it was definitely at some point in time a very fine object, like an expensive, nice thing, because it's like embroidered silk. that it could have been part of a saint's skirt. Like, it could have definitely been a relic that was taken.
Yeah.
Like, this is all absolutely reasonable for this object. Reginald replies to Mr. Wallace with all of his theories and speculation. Mr. Wallace, you may believe that, but I know that it was given to my ancestors by the fairies. To which Mr. Wallace replies, Sir Reginald, I bow to your superior knowledge.
That's too good.
I love how much the clan loves and cares for and respects this flag.
That's so funny.
So other experts have dated this flag to having been made, like, the silk coming into existence somewhere between 300 and 600, like, BC.
When Gaelic started.
So, like, it's, here's the thing, though. Just, it can be that old and also be something that Harold, like, took while in the Middle East.
Because, mm-hmm.
like, it could have been an old thing that he stole as an old relic and just stole it, you know, 400 years after it was made. So it was old when he stole it, and now it's even older now.
Yeah.
From whenever he did stuff around Constantinople. They know that. And so this is, like, a very likely way that this made it here. Because it did come from there. They're pretty confident with that. I think they've recently done further testing, but it wasn't mentioned anywhere in what I looked at. So I don't know if it, like, they were starting it or if it was, like, now permanently on display. And that's why it was really exciting, because I saw it in the news recently. And I don't remember why. And I didn't even think to look
we'll
it up
to
until
look
right
into
now.
It to bring it into another episode.
And I'm sure I missed tradition surrounding this. Like, I did my best. At this point, I needed to end my research, basically.
Yeah, that's a lot.
It was a lot.
It's a Halloween episode.
It was, like, a Halloween episode length of stuff. See, whatever the true origin is of the flag, though, the chief and the clan MacLeod have a profound respect for its powers. And that's really neat. I like that. I really like that they have all this tradition and magic.
What did I say
in
my notes? That they're proud of their folklore.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it is.
This is a great example.
Yep.
And for as many origin stories as it has, there's definitely a lot of folklore even with, it seems like, within the clan. Because, like, more than one of these I got from, like MacLeod in the sources. So, like, they don't have a firm answer. They just know it's mythological in origin is how there's... That's all I know for sure. It has powers. It brings luck. Anyway, that's the fairy flag of Dungeon Castle.
I have not heard of it.
I didn't expect there to be this much on it when I picked the topic.
Something old.
Scotland episode.
Yeah. Well, try not to kill anybody and don't mess with Ouija boards.
Bye.